welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 243 of the podcast. And it is the 15th of November, 2015, as I record this on a wet and windy day in Bath. So first up, I want to just acknowledge what happened in Paris on Friday. Now, I don't do politics on this show, but I just wanted to mention it because events like this help put things in perspective and certainly, important to focus on what's really important. Cherish your loved ones, write your hearts out because life is short. And yeah, consider what's really important. So if you've been putting off some kind of decision or there's something you really want to do, or if you want to finish that book, just do it. Seriously, maybe now is the right time. So I always sit down and write, and when these things happen, I write a list of all the things I'm grateful for, and just wanted to say thank you for you guys. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting me. And let's move on. And this is an upbeat show, so I will make it upbeat now. So today I have an interview with Mark McGuinness about motivation for creative people. And we discuss values and what's important, what drives us. And I think you'll get a lot out of it, whatever stage you're at with your writing. And Mark is a friend of mine, so I do tend to share more, I guess. It's quite a discussion about things. And Mark writes nonfiction, so he talks a lot about that. But also the interesting thing about the value stuff is that working out what people's motivations are can really help you with writing fiction. So I definitely found the interview really interesting. So on personal updates, Risen Gods is with beta readers and my proofreader. And obviously I share every week what's going on, and you'll know that the first draft of Risen Gods only took us 19 days, but we're now in sort of month two of editing and proofreading, beta reading, all that type of thing. But almost there. These things take time. I've written some notes on a short story that I am going to write and submit to a short story competition in the UK, judged by Stephen King, run by The Guardian, and it is only for UK authors and horror focused, I guess. So I'm quite excited about that. And I'm going to be writing a sort of dark Christmas story. But because it's in the competition, I won't be able to release it. I won't be able to self-publish it separately yet. I should get that back next year, though, whether I win or not. You never know. Got to be in it to win it and all that. This week, I was also at Robert McKee's Storynomics seminar. Last year, I did the 3-day story summit, story seminar, whatever you want to call it, Robert McKee's story. And it is fantastic. And I would definitely recommend that. The Storynomics seminar it's quite a different angle. It's aimed at marketers, CEOs, business people, talking about using story in business. And I booked it because I have been interested for a while, because I spent 13 years as a business consultant and I have a business background. I really was interested in maybe writing a book on story in business, because, now I write fiction and I still do business. But what was so interesting about the day, I think for all of us, what McKee says, and he had a whole load of, data points around why advertising, doesn't really work anymore, and how people are immune to it, and why advertising has to be done with story. And he had some brilliant adverts during the day that really helped illustrate the power of the story and the emotion. So the big thing there, I think, the big takeaway, and of course the day was mainly stepping through his structure of story. So for me, it was a sort of revisiting what I learned last year and what I've been trying to put into my books. But what was fascinating is that we all need to know this stuff. If you write nonfiction, you still have to know how to structure a story, because most content marketing is now story. Whether you're selling a bank or a widget or an experience or a product or a shop, you know, there are so many things. I mean, around Christmas, we start getting all the emotional stories, don't we, coming out. But these are important to move people. And of course, it's very difficult to make sure you don't manipulate people at the same time. But yeah, I really enjoyed that. And I have, again, pages and pages and pages of notes. It's like I have all these blog posts that I want to write. But I haven't been blogging very much recently because of all the move, you know, and the weekly podcast. I mean, you guys hear what's going on anyway, but I do have some blog posts definitely coming soon. Okay. Oh, and the co-writing book, we did the cover, and Jay's just going through that, and then we'll get it proofread. So again, that one will also be out probably in beginning of December. Oh, this week I also chaired a meeting of the international thriller writers in the UK in London, and always good to hang out with other authors. And I thought you guys might be encouraged by the number of traditionally published authors in the room who asked how to set up an email list. And I mean, I think sometimes we get the feeling that we're behind. I mean, I get the feeling I'm behind all the time. I'm like, oh, I should be doing that. I should be doing this. I mean, it's crazy all the things we think we should be doing. But don't think you are behind. The indie author community is actually way ahead on marketing. And if you haven't started an email list, don't worry. Lots of people haven't. And it's one of those, the best day to start a tree is, you know, 20 years ago or today type of things. So yeah, good. Okay, so here's what you have sent me this week. What have you been doing while listening to the show? Joanna Campbell-Slan is making dollhouse furnishings, which is super cute. Richard has been creating his new website, author richardetodd.com, while listening to the show. Fantastic. My writings have spilled out of my original genre, so I needed a catch-all place. Yes, that tends to happen. We all tend to write lots of different books over time. If you get the bug, it's not going to stop. Leah Stella Stevens says, I'm listening to your podcast every day while I do my courier job. They are fantastic. I love them. In that case, Leah, you will probably be going through the backlist, which, you know, sometimes I think I should listen to some of the backlist, because since I started this in 2009, quite a few things have changed. But I didn't actually used to do personal introductions. I just used to get straight into the interview, because I didn't think anybody wanted to know anything about what I was doing. So I wish I had recorded introductions back then, because it's like a moment in time that's paused. And yeah, really interesting. Carlina Angwin, I wanted to say hello again to Carlina, who said, from last week, I was driving and nearly wrecked because I heard my name during my favourite podcast. So I thought I'd do it again this week and say, okay, everyone, this is a driving warning. If you do tweet me or email me about what you're doing, I may well read out your name on the show. Be safe, everybody, please. Seamus Anthony, rocking the website while listening to my favourite podcast. Thank you. Monica T. Rodriguez says, you like snakes. Took this picture at a small zoo in New York. Sign on the window reads, what would you do if it broke? I wouldn't be that bothered. I think it was a big python in there, and they don't move that fast. Then we have a two brilliant handyman freelance construction photos this week. Tyler Matthews says, listening to back episodes while putting base trim on, and a really cool, super grinning photo. And then MJ or Mike Brudenell says, listening while working freelance construction, also picture of floor tiling and Mike in safety glasses. Now, Mike and Tyler, you both have the same hipster beard and safety glasses, which made me laugh a lot. Again, another reason I really need to sort out the Creative Pen podcast, you know, board, where we put, in fact, I should just put everything on Pinterest or something. But yeah, very cool. Brittany Fichter sent my next book to the editor and celebrated by listening to the show and decorating a cake. And it looks really yummy, Brittany. You would do very well on a bake-off, I think. I personally am not a baker. SJ Pajonas says, listening to the Creative Pen podcast on the plane from Charleston to JFK, listening about co-writing, and sent me a picture from the airport. Pamela Olivia Brown, listening to the collaboration podcast while preparing to submit NaNoWriMo word count for the week. Brilliant. And all of you doing NaNoWriMo, I do hope it's going well. Remember, it doesn't matter if you don't hit the 50,000. Whatever you do will be better than nothing. And my first NaNo, I did 20,000 words, and that became my first novel, Stone of Fire. So that really changed my life. NaNoWriMo can change your life. Definitely. And Jennifer Aramiva says, listening to the backlist while checking links on MailChimp workflow automation. Just the latest marketing idea from you. Thank you. Yes, I'm still going through the automation workflow on my email list. It's back on my list for this week. Goodness me, this, you know, again, coming back to, there's always so much to do, you know. It never stops. I'd also say that back in, must have been earlier this year, and I don't have the number in front of me, but I interviewed Frances Caballo from Social Media Just for Writers, and she recommended a social warfare plugin for putting nice pictures from your podcast and your tweets on social media. And ever since then, I've been meaning to do it. And I'd like to say that I have now done it. So if you do use Pinterest or you like to share on social media, I have finally sorted out doing a decent graphic for the podcast episode. And my lovely assistant, Alexandra, is going through and doing the backlist as well. So I'm happy about that. That's something that's been on my list for ages and ages and ages. I'm also in the next couple of weeks doing a move of my hosting provider. It's like I have these cleanup exercises because the website now has got big enough that I really need a more dedicated hosting service. So that is, again, it's one of those difficult things, and I'm moving my email hosting, and oh my goodness. So just, and why was I going to tell you that? Oh, it was more that whatever level you're at, there are always more things to do. I think it's that I really hit the wall last week. I was really tired, and thinking again, you know, the Paris stuff. And I mean, there's always disasters happening. You know, we all know that. And it's really about, okay, seriously, what is the most important thing today? Now, you can't always put off these tasks until later, but you can put them off if they're, you know, if you're really just hitting the wall. So with the whole moving house and everything, it's taken a lot longer than I expected to become more normal again. But I'm feeling like we're getting into more normal phase soon in the next week or so. So I'm hoping to get all of these jobs done. I've got a list of 11 big jobs to do before Christmas, which include books and things. Courses, all kinds of stuff. But so just to say, don't worry, it does never stop. So you have to stop yourself and have days off sometimes. Okay, enough waffling. This podcast episode is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and there will be a word from our sponsor coming up next. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks especially to new patrons Constance Sayers, Sperry Editorial, Jeffrey Allen Plochet, and Marion Hermanson. Thank you so much, and to everybody supporting. And I will be recording the extra Q&A show in the next week and sending that out on Patreon to listeners, to supporters. And that will be based on your questions. And on Patreon, if you'd like to support the show, you can just give a dollar or a couple of dollars per show to a maximum of 2 shows a month. So less than a coffee a month. And now you'll get that extra monthly Q&A as well. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, thank you. Here's a word from our sponsor, Kobo Writing Life.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark LaFave, Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations for Kobo. What is Kobo? Kobo is a global ebook company born out of Canada. Kobo is available in 190 countries around the world. Now, authors like Joanna Penn already are taking full advantage of the fact that while there may be certain players, world's longest river, that exist and are quite prominent in a few nations, Kobo is available and continuing to expand and grow in territories around the world. And one of the wonderful things about being a Kobo Writing Life author is when you look at that dashboard and you see that you sold a book in some country that you probably haven't heard of before. Check us out at KoboWritingLife.com. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
I'm here with Mark McGuinness. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Joanna.
Welcome back on the show. So just a little introduction. Mark is a poet, non-fiction author, creative coach, and professional speaker. And his latest book is Motivation for Creative People. And we all need a bit of that. So Mark, just let's start off with a bit of a definition, because everyone thinks they know what motivation is. Well, I think they do. But how are you defining motivation and you know, what are the high level sort of things we need to know?
Okay, so the first thing to say is that it isn't some magical quality that you either have inside you or you don't. And it isn't something that you need in order to, you know, you can't say, well, I can't start writing my novel yet because I'm not quite motivated enough, because that's not motivation, that's resistance. And I know you know about that from talking to Mr. Pressfield. So I deliberately have a very broad definition in the book, and I say motivation is whatever gets you moving. So it's something that has an effect. It's not something that you're waiting for in order to make the effect happen. And I've got four basic kinds of motivation that I talk about in the book. One is the intrinsic, what I call the joy of work. This is why we are writers, why we love to do what we do. The other one is extrinsic, is kind of a balancing that one. And that is the rewards for work. So that's the money, the fame, the critical reputation, the exciting opportunities, the, I don't know, going to speak at writers' conferences, all the stuff that we get as a result of having done our work. And then I've got another axis that I look at. So I'm using, I know not everyone can see this, but, you know, if you can imagine a pinwheel, but if you're on the video, you can see the pinwheel on the cover of the book, which my brilliant designer, Irene Hoffman, came up with. I said I wanted a way of showing how these four motivations fit together, and this is what Irene came up with. And I said, okay, you nailed it.
and the pinwheel, I guess, more like a windmill. Like a windmill.
It's like a windmill,
with,
yes.
With four different things on. Yeah. They have to work together.
Children's paper thing, and you can blow on it, or the breeze catches it, and it spins around, and they all blur in together. So you've got, it's like two blades of it on opposing sides. You've got intrinsic, extrinsic. You've got work, rewards for work. But the other kind of axis for the two blades are your own personal motivations, your core values, and what I call social motivation, which is influences from people around you. And obviously there's a tension between those as well. And I know plenty of your listeners will be familiar with, well, I want to do this thing for my career, and the world seems to be pushing me into that direction instead. So what I'm doing in the book is showing it's not, you know, we don't say, well, do you write for love or money? I mean, it's kind of a false dichotomy. You write for both, but you've got to think about the writing for love and the writing for money at different times. And it's, you know, do you please yourself or do you please your audience? Well, you're kind of looking to do both.
And I think that's the kind of the magic thing about the book for me, was that realization that you can have the different things. I guess they have to be at different times, don't they? Maybe you could talk a bit about how, you know, because sometimes I feel driven by just I love working, you know, so much. And then other times I'm driven by, you know, I must write this book because I need some more income, for example. So how can we balance the four things so that we get it right?
Okay, well, you've hit on something that is absolutely true, but it's also quite a hard sell for the book, which is it's about balance. And I was thinking, how can I write a really great tagline that will get people excited about balance? Because nobody does. I don't have a balance in my life, like, you know, but in a way you do. But, you know, so the balance that I struck in the tagline, which is really what the promise I'm trying to make in the book, is how to stay creative while gaining money, fame, and reputation. And I think it's that stay is critical, because I'm assuming that anyone listening to this is already creative. There's lots of books saying this is how you can be creative. Well, most of the writers and creators I work with say, well, I already do that, but what about the money and the fame? How do I balance it out with that? Because, you know, the research has shown us that money is a creativity killer. Pursuing fame is a creativity killer. Worrying about what the critics think is a creativity killer. And yet, and there's a lot of research, Dan Pink has talked about this among other people, that intrinsic motivation, doing it for love, is when we're at our most creative. And which is all very well, but if this is my business, and it is, I can't just sit and write what I want. I've got to somehow find a way of dealing with the money, the fame, the reputation. Mm. So coming back to your question, timing is really crucial here. So this morning I was working on a poem, and one reason I was working on this particular poem is I do have a deadline tomorrow. See, even poets get deadlines. I'm going to my teacher, Mimi Calvati's workshop. And I particularly want to get her feedback on this piece. So that kind of got it on the schedule. But in the moment, I couldn't be thinking about what people are going to say tomorrow. I can't control that. All I could think about was the actual poem. So I had 2 or 3 hours this morning. I'm just like in this hermetically sealed capsule where all I'm thinking about is the poem. And it's the same with writing a book like the Motivation one. Yeah, I took a business decision to say I'm going to write this kind of book because it helps my business in various ways. But each morning when I sat down or stood up to write, I had to just be thinking of my ideal reader. You know, has she really understood what I'm saying yet? Have I got this across? Is it lively enough, entertaining enough, meaningful enough? And so I think, but then at the end of each day, I would kind of look at what I've got and see how that fits in the big picture. Mm. So that ability to zoom in and zoom out and look at different aspects at different times, I think is really critical. If you're going to be a successful professional, if you just want to do it for fun, then do it for fun and don't think about anything else.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I generally think that the people listening to this show go a bit further.
They do. You push them, Joe.
I do. And I want to come back to core values in a minute and the personal side. I think the intrinsic extrinsic is more obvious. I think we understand that dichotomy, the love of it versus the love of money, for example, rewards, fame. But the social, I was thinking about, because you and I are both fans of Seth Godin, and I went to see him this week, and he talked about this phrase, people like us do things like this. And that phrase just got me. And I was like, oh my goodness, it's so true. So that's like a social thing, I guess. You know, people who are creative create stuff, for example. Writers, people like us writers write things. So how does that idea fit into the social? I guess it's the social side, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really, and Steve Pressfield talks about this in terms of creative cultures. Mm. He said, if you're in a culture, it's like joining the Marines or Manchester United or something like that. And there's certain standards of behavior that are expected. So, for instance, the workshop I'm going to tomorrow with Mimi is a very unique workshop. I mean, I'd been to a lot of writing classes before I met Mimi about, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago. And generally, I had been at the top of the class and it'd been quite nice. And people say, oh, yeah, that's good. You know, there's good lines there. And then I went to Mimi's class and I realized I was way in the bottom half. And she would say things like, yeah, that line's good, but why don't you make the rest of the poem as good as that? And I'd be like, what? But I got the sense that people like the people in this group wouldn't try and make the rest of the poem that good. So I worked with Mimi a long time and that's become ingrained that it's, you know, whatever level you're writing at, it's always, there's always an opportunity for laziness. There's always somebody who can set you an example and show you actually there's a higher standard that you can meet. So yeah, I completely agree with what Seth's saying on that.
Yeah, and it's funny you saying there about excuse for laziness or whatever, because that's one of my other questions, because I think a lot of people feel that they want to write and, you know, actually they do feel like they want to write and they are motivated, and yet it's still hard to sit down and actually write words. So how does that motivation fit with actual practice of doing the work?
Well, I think we're talking about resistance, right?
Yeah.
So, again, and actually I invited Steve to have his say in the book because I thought I could write about resistance, but, you know, what would I say that Steve wouldn't? So very kindly, he contributed a short interview to the book, Stephen Pressfield, where I said, because I've been writing about intrinsic motivation, or I call it the joy of work, and how great it is to be creating and have your freedom and challenge and inspiration and all of that. And I thought, well, okay, but at a certain point, somebody's going to ask, that's all very well, so why is it so hard for me to sit down and do it? So Steve's answer is resistance, which he defines as this invisible force that rises up inside us as soon as we commit to a big challenge, whether that's artistic or entrepreneurial or fitness or career-wise. It's trying to persuade us that anything else is more urgent, more important, more worth doing at this moment. So, you know, and I think just the fact of recognizing that's what it is. So I had it this morning with the poem. It's like I went down to get some coffee and my wife said, so how's it going? And I said, it's really hard. And she laughed at me and she said, isn't that why you always tell me that that's what makes it fun, because it's hard? And I said, yes, from a distance. But it just kind of reminded me, you know, I had to go up there. And one of my rules is if I've decided I'm going to commit to writing time, it's I'm allowed to write and I'm allowed to sit there and stare into space, but I'm not allowed to do anything else. Mm. Drinking coffee is kind of allowed.
Yeah. No internet, no social media.
So at a certain point you think, well, okay, I'm here for another hour and a half. I might as well do a bit. So, but very often it's a bit like meditation, you know, it's if you stay with the difficult feeling, whether it's depression or anxiety or anger or fear or whatever, and you don't try and change it, you're just patiently holding it in your awareness, it will change. Mm. And I got to lunchtime and I looked and I thought, actually, I do have a draft there. You know, it's not perfect, but it is a draft, and there certainly wasn't one. You know, like an hour ago, I was in danger of doing the walk of shame to the class tomorrow.
Mm.
And, you know, so just staying with it, I think, very, I'm just acknowledging, okay, I'm experiencing resistance.
Yeah, and so it's interesting. So you said the walk of shame to the class there, which is a social motivation, but also a personal motivation, because you want to, in a way, there's competition there, right? You want to be seen as a good poet.
Of course. And yeah. I know I've got that much ego invested in it. So what I'm trying to do is use my ego in a positive way to kind of put my way into doing it. So the example I give in the book is the story of Anthony Trollope, you know, the Victorian novelist, who would get up at 5:30 every morning to write his novels. And he wrote like 27 of these things while he was working full time for the post office. And he didn't have KDP scale royalties, so he probably had to sell a lot more books than we do to quit our jobs, but he did it eventually. And what I'm thinking about is, you know, did he love writing? Of course he loved writing. Otherwise, you can't write 27 novels unless you really like writing novels. Mm. Did he want the money? Yes, and we know that from his autobiography, because he'd worked out his financial goal for the year and then how many novels he'd have to write and sell, and then how many words per hour he had to write in order to hit his target. So he was really fixated on both of those. Now, looking at the personal and the social axis, you could say, well, getting up at 5:30 in the morning, there's a lot of personal discipline there and ambition and drive for achievement, which indeed there was. But the thing that clinched it, which I thought was really nice, is he paid his old manservant an extra £5 a year, which is quite a lot in those days, to wake him with the coffee at 5:30. And he said, the old man never showed himself any mercy. He said, and therefore neither did I. And he said something like, I owe that guy more than anyone else for the literary success that I've had. Do you imagine, you know, if you're the master of the house in Victorian England, and your servant, your old servant who's older than you, has got up earlier than you to make the coffee, and you're lying there in bed, are you going to go, or can I have another 5 minutes?
Mm.
or it's a bit cold. You know, I mean, he's going to lose so much face. So I think he deliberately kind of baited the trap with his vanity that he would lose a lot of face if he would do the walk of shame. Imagine if he woke up and he drifted off and the old guy just left the coffee by the bed. That would have just been unspeakable.
Yeah, and I think that ego thing is really interesting. And I think many of us struggle with this. And I try, you know, I'm a very positive person, but we all still get... We could call it professional jealousy. We could call it comparisonitis. And yet I try and what I often try and do is email people and say, well done, you've done amazing things, or get them on the podcast and go, you've done amazing things, and try and make their success more, just something that I can aspire to, as opposed to feel negative about. Is that, how does that fit into motivation?
That's a really good question, because on the one hand, I think it's really important to compare yourself to the best in your field and to aim as high as you can, because if you're aiming here, you're going to get higher than if you're aiming here. Mm. You know, considering we always fall short of where we aim. So at the minute, I'm doing a translation project translating Geoffrey Chaucer's masterpiece, which is, of course, Troilus and Crusade.
Yes, everyone knows that one.
But he actually finished it, for starters. It's one of my favourite poems. So I'm translating it into contemporary verse, but keeping all the original metre and rhyme scheme and whatever, which is quite hard, you know? And obviously, if I'm trying to be Chaucer, then I'm going to fail, right? I mean, I ain't going to be as good as him. But it really stretches me to aim that high. Mm-hmm. And I know it will, even if this translation is a failure, then it will have a positive effect on everything else I do. So I've got to kind of aspire, but be okay with falling short and not get too judgmental about it. Because the other way around I could do it is hiding from measuring myself against the best, combined with getting really agitated and jealous about such and such of my contemporaries who's been published or been given this award or that thing that I feel I deserve. And that doesn't do anybody any good. So really self-awareness comes into this a lot. And if you're in any doubt, your body will tell you. Because if you're, you know, say you're, I don't know who the top person in your field would be. I mean, who would be?
Stephen King.
Stephen King, right. Okay, fine. So if you were to get up and say, okay, I'm going to really take Stephen King as an exemplar and learn what I can and aim that high. And if you're doing that in an aspirational way, chances are you check into your body, you feel fired up, you feel excited. If you're beating yourself up for not being as good as Stephen King, then, you know, the shoulders are going to go down. You're going to get that tight, constricted feeling or whatever. So your body is, I always say to clients, your body is your best coach, because it's giving you feedback in the moment about what you're doing. And I think a lot of these motivational things, you can say, well, yes, on the one hand, it's good, but on the other hand, this is the pitfall. And it's how we handle that and use that really makes the difference. And so that self-awareness has to come into it somewhere.
And now I hear people going, well, that's all very well, Mark, but when I try and do, you know, I do my writing and I feel great, but when I have to do all the marketing that you have to do as an author these days, my body feels really down and I don't enjoy that part. I mean, that's the most common thing people say. It's like, if we only had to do the joy of creation, you know, things would be great, although that's probably not true as well. But how do we balance, you know, you're a creative entrepreneur. You don't just sit around all day translating Chaucer or writing poems. You're a businessman. How do we create these positive motivations around the entrepreneurial side, the marketing side, as well as the creation?
Well, I got a nice piece of wisdom from another couple of coaches I know, guys called Steve Chandler and Rich Litvin. And they have this idea that in whatever you do, there is the work, there's the two boxes. Just imagine the listening and the audio. I keep forgetting because I can see Joe on the video. I know she can see, but you may not. One box is the work, so in this case it's writing. And the other box is the business of the work. And nearly all of us, whatever creative field we're in, we love doing the work and we hate doing the business. And Rich and Steve point out, if you make the box as the same box or as close to being the same box as you can, that reduces a lot of the resistance. So as long as I see marketing is completely different and antithetical to creativity, I'm not going to do it. So this is one of the wonderful things about content marketing, because it all depends on creating media content, whether that's a blog post or a newsletter or a podcast or a video or whatever. And as I like to point out to creative professionals, well, who's the expert at creating creative content? That would be us, right? So I only really got interested in marketing when I discovered I could do it by blogging. I thought, great. So instead of picking up the phone or going out to all these networking events or whatever, I can just be writing stuff and putting it out there and leaving a trail of breadcrumbs back to what I do. Yeah, let me at it. So, and it's the same with you in the podcast. I mean, you listening to you week after week, it sounds as though you're having a good time.
I am.
And your listeners are having a good time, and your interviewees are having a good time. And we're aware that this is your business, and you signal when you tell us when you have a new book out or whatever, but it's not, you're not ramming it down our throats. You know, we're grown ups. So, what's not to like?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's interesting, just coming back to Trollope, you saying that, you know, people think it's a modern thing that we would divide the number of dollars you want to make by the number of books, by the number of hours. You know, as Dean Wesley Smith is the big proponent of doing the math and working it out. And it's so, it was so interesting that you said that about Trollope, that that was still happening then. And actually, the rules haven't changed, have they, in terms of you still need a certain number of books to make a living, or a certain number let's not say poems. How many poems do you need to make a living, Mark?
Well, you need a really good business model around it. That's what you need, Joe. It doesn't necessarily rely on selling poems.
No, exactly. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. But I wanted to come back to the personal side and the core values, because that's a really interesting part of the book, quite a substantial part of the book, really, looking at what are your core values and how does that affect things. So can you talk a bit about, you know, what are core values and how can people use those to make decisions about motivation?
Okay. So, yeah, values have been an interest of mine for a long time, since when I was doing psychotherapy, because they're a really good shorthand for what is most important to you. So a value is really an abstract statement of the kind of thing that you value. So freedom is, I know, one that's close to your heart. For me, empowerment is another one that I use a lot in my work. In the book, I talk about seven. They're not the most important, but they cover quite a lot of the bases. So I think I've got adventure, I've got beauty, I've got compassion, justice, power, pleasure, and there's another one.
And some other things.
Something else, right? And really, it helps to think of them relatively, because I think everybody listening to this will go, well, those things are all important. You know, we all need compassion and justice and pleasure and freedom and empowerment, okay? What's interesting is, what is the relative importance? I mean, if you were listening to this and I were to say to you, what's more important, adventure or compassion? Or what's more important, beauty or pleasure or power? Now, depending which one you pick relative to the others, that gives an indication of your values hierarchy. And what that translates into is what we know as the personality. Because really, personality is a side effect of your values and the way you express them. So you value power, you're going to come across as a powerful person. And you're going to gravitate towards positions of power. And you're going to challenge people who occupy those. If you value knowledge, then you're going to be spending a lot more time on the internet or in the library, out there in the world seeking it. And so one exercise that I'd invite you to do is get a list of values, and maybe we could link in the show notes to Steve Pavlina's on his blog. He's got this massive long list of values. I mean, I've got seven in the book, which I say to people start as a starting point. And then just ask yourself, well, which is the most important and which is the least important? And then try and work them out between that. And then if you're really struggling, like, say, pleasure versus security, you would say, well, you know, you've got a windfall. You've got an extra £3,000. What are you going to save it, or are you going to splash it on a holiday? Something like that. Okay, why would you do this? Well, firstly, because when you go through this process, generally by itself, it produces a lot of insights. People go, oh, right, okay. So not everyone prioritizes this over that, particularly if you do it with a group. Sometimes I'll do it with a group, and I'll list, you know, 9 or 10 values, and we have an argument about which is the most important. And that's very revealing. Because very often when we make decisions that aren't good for us, it's because we've lost sight of our values because we're spending too much time listening to other people's ideas or trying to do the sensible thing or being influenced by people around us who may have the best of intentions, but they don't know us as well as we know ourselves. So for me, empowerment, you know, if a new opportunity comes along or a new idea for a project or even, you know, the topic of, say, an article to write, one of the questions I'll ask is, well, do I feel empowered when I think about doing this? And will it be empowering for the clients, for the readers that I'm going to share it with? And if the answer is no, then I'm not doing it. Even though logically that I could really persuade myself that would be a good idea, because I know from experience that's when I screw things up, when I listen to the logic rather than the value.
What was so interesting as well with that value chapter is it struck me as well with people writing fiction that one of the really good ways to write a character that's quite different is actually by taking a value and making that the core value instead of the one that you have. I mean, I know that my main protagonist, strong female characters, have the same freedom, you know, value as I do. And I, you know, when I was reading, I thought it would be really interesting to take something that's not completely opposite, because opposite seems easy, whereas it's something that's kind of almost, you know, tangential that might be more difficult. Would that be right?
That's a really fun way to do it. I've sometimes done this with novelists. It's like the analogy I sometimes use is it's like a mixing desk. If you're in a recording studio and you've got the bass and you've got the drums and you've got the lead vocal and the guitar and whatever, and you can slide these and make one more prominent and the other one less prominent. So you might just take two of them in your hierarchy and just swap them around. And just see, and then immediately you would have to come up with a decision that the character has to make where they take one choice that you wouldn't take. And that just starts to lead you in a slightly different direction. Or, you know, that there might well be a dilemma that is set up, or a character who challenges that value.
And it explains a lot about the self-publishing movement, I guess, and people who really, really do not want it at all. I mean, that kind of, is that stability versus freedom, for example?
Yeah, I think so. And there's also something about creative control versus the willingness to do it yourself. It's like, I don't know if you get this, but I mean, like halfway through the production, because you know, I'd written the book, it took me 18 months. Halfway through the production, this was the first time I'd done the paperback and the ebook together. And I was going, okay, now I see why people have publishers. This is quite hard work, isn't it? And I'm really tired because I finished writing the book and I could do with a break. So it would be lovely to have someone to hand it over to them. But then I thought, think about all the, I mean, set aside the money, just think about all the control that I would have to give up. That if it's my book and I'm publishing it, I have the last word on everything from editorial decisions to what goes on the cover to the title to the price, whatever. And to me, that control is really important, which I guess the slightly more attractive word is freedom.
Yeah, and I mean empowerment as well. I mean,
so it would really conflict with my value of empowerment if I had a publisher telling me, no, you say they said, oh, you've got to cut this whole section on values out. And I'd be like, oh, but I need that. But depending on the relationship, you don't necessarily have that choice if you've got a publisher. But, you know, having said all of that, someone with a different hierarchy of values is going to be much more comfortable working with a traditional publisher.
Yeah, agreed. And here's an interesting random question for you. You've been a coach for years. You've been a psychotherapist. You're a poet. You've got a lot, and you've worked with as a creative coach for years and years. I mean, there's a lot that you could write about. Why choose the order of the books that you're writing as a non-fiction author? So you started with resilience, and then you've done motivation. Why are those the things that you're writing about, and how are you choosing which books to write next out of your vast experience?
Well, you know, I wish I could say there's a grand strategic plan. I mean, resilience really came, because I did that 3 years ago, and that came out of talking to you and also to CJ Lyons and seeing the amazing things you were doing with books. Because up to that point, you know, I'd spoken to a few publishers and had offers, but I didn't want to give up the control. So I thought, well, I'll just keep blogging and doing my other things. But then when I saw what you were doing in the self-publishing space, I thought, okay, maybe I could do that. But I wanted to do it. I just thought I would try it as an experiment. And the thing that I noticed with resilience was I've got this free 26-week course that people sign up for on my mailing list. And it's a guide, a career guide for creative professionals. And we start off with goal setting and your vision. And we look at productivity. We look at resistance and all the kind of basic skills you need for a career. And there was a question I put at the end of the course. I said, which has been the most valuable lesson and why? And of course, the one that stood out was the one that I just put in as an afterthought. I thought, I better say something about rejection and criticism. And I was getting emails from people saying, I need more about this. This is a big issue for me. And I thought, well, okay, let's try that. That came from my audience. I can help people with this. And I discovered that having, you know, coached and done therapy with people for about 15, 16 years at that time, I had quite a lot to say about it. So I wrote that up, and it, you know, it went down well. People liked it. They said it was helpful. And then when it came to motivation, actually, I talked to you about this last year, didn't I? Because I never intended this to be a full-length book. This was one where I thought it had been an ebook that I'd written years ago for managers about how to motivate creative people. Discovered that actually the creative people were more interested in learning that than the managers were, which is kind of obvious in retrospect. And I thought, okay, well, I'll turn that 15,000 word ebook into a book, a free or low price book on Amazon called Motivation for Creative People. 12 months later, I was still writing it, and it just kept getting longer and longer and longer. And I talked to you when it was about 45, 50,000 words, and you said, you know, you're not going to give this away, are you? And I was like, I guess I'm not. And I realized I'd written a full-length book almost by accident. So, you know, and then I really sat down and thought, okay, well, this is a bigger, more ambitious book. So I went back and I rewrote about half of it based on that realization of the scope of what I was doing. And the kind of the intrinsic motivation took over. I just kept finding I had more and more to say about it, and it got more and more interesting, and there was more and more that I thought, well, I needed to cover that too. So maybe the next book I will be a bit more strategically considered. I've got a few options that I'm thinking about at the moment. And I guess maybe I'll use the pinwheel to help me work it out.
Ah, yeah, there you go. And also asking your audience, I mean, what you did with that first one, you know, you basically almost did a survey in that you had a question that people could respond to. So that's kind of what that was. The other thing I just want to come back to, in the book, you use Shakespeare as another example. You've got, you know, obviously you're a very literary man, and the book is full of really interesting little nuggets. And I love that you use Shakespeare, who is kind of lauded as the height of literature, somebody who wrote for money, you use the phrase churned out, which I love, because that's what people say about romance writers. Oh, they just churn it out, you know, like Shakespeare. And that he reused things, he copied things. So, and he was an entrepreneur. So just talk a bit more about what you think about Shakespeare and how people can use his example to help them.
I just find this endlessly fascinating, because these days we think of poetry as being the most airy-fairy, uncommercial, head-in-the-clouds type of activity. that is such a polar opposite to anything resembling business or even commercial creativity. And yet, the guy who wrote what's generally considered to be the greatest poetry in English was doing it to get bums on seats and to fill the courtyard of the Globe Theatre. And it was his business, and he made a lot of money from it. So there must be a way of kind of squaring the circle. You know, he managed to do it. And interestingly, when he was using a different business model, which was patronage, he was writing these long things like Venus and Adonis and The Rape of Lucrece that nobody ever reads, not to mention the sonnets. And all of these are, well, some of them are explicitly dedicated to the Earl of Southampton, and we don't quite know who the Mr. W.H. in the sonnets is, so let's set that one aside. But really, it's not his best work, the stuff when he was being paid to do literary stuff for the high-minded people. But when he went into the theatre as popular entertainment, there was something about that that sparked the poetry, which is, you know, at the heart of the plays. And I find, you know, again, we don't know that much about his life, but we do know that he was part of a very innovative business structure, that he and the other king's men paid about £1,000 each to be part sharers in this. So he went from being a hack who was being paid by companies to churn out, or more likely rewrite and rehash, old plays. And we know from the surviving records that playwrights didn't get a lot for that, so they had to write them fast and quick. Well, then suddenly he's gone from that to being part of the Lord Chamberlain's men, later the King's men, and he gets a share of the gate at every performance. And he writes exclusively for his own company. So what he's doing is building intellectual property assets for himself and his business partners, and they're exploiting that. So now there is a recent theory that actually he was doing some wool trading on behalf of the family. This is just literally the last couple of months has come out. So he may have been more of a wheeler dealer than we're aware of. And also he may have got more of his money from wool versus playwriting, but certainly he was doing commercial entertainment. And so for me, that is really inspiring, that you can be a poet and you can be an entrepreneur. Certainly managed to stay creative while gaining money, fame and reputation.
So. Yeah, and still now, and I mean, maybe that's, you know, kind of what writing for TV is right now. I mean, that would probably be the equivalent, wouldn't it, of bums on seats?
I think he would have got into self-publishing too. I mean, I think he would have seen an opportunity there and thought, you know, he would have inveigled his way into. I mean, there's a load of stuff going on for writers now, and I think he would have been at the forefront of that in some way.
Yeah, and of course there were fewer rules as well, I suppose. And well, I think what people get trapped so much is by the rules of what they've been told they have to do. But realistically, what you're saying, and I believe, you know, the only rule in inverted commas now is that you have to write if you want to be a writer. I mean, and you have to publish, really.
I don't think it's helpful to think about rules, because that suggests it's imposed from somebody else. But I think there are principles. Like, I mean, I know you've studied, say, the principles of storytelling in a lot of depth, you know, far more than I have. But even you could take something like a sonnet and say, well, there's no rules that it needs to be 14 line long and rhyme in this particular combination, but there's a principle that actually a poem about that length allows that certain amount of thought. And as Don Patterson said, you know, if all the sonnets that ever existed in the world disappeared overnight, then the sonnet form would probably reappear by tomorrow tea time. Because it's just the right kind of size and shape for a certain kind of thing. Just the way that, I don't know, a 70,000 word novel gives you enough space to explore an idea or a character or a situation in a certain way. And that, you know, as people like this, you know, Sean Coyne and people will show us, there are certain recurrent patterns that have been shown to be effective. So I like playing with the patterns. I don't think about rules in so much.
Yeah, I agree that the patterns and constructs, like I'm just about to write a short story for a competition that's being judged by Stephen King that I'm just super excited about. I know. And, you know, and there are specific rules about it. You know, he's given a prompt and it's max 4,000 words. And so I've just been mainlining short stories by Stephen King and other writers. And you can see, like, there are books on the form, but I'm preferring to read them over and over and over again to kind of embed the form without copying, really. Yep. And that's kind of, you know, what you're saying. There is a form, and there's a form to motivation too, like you said. And, you know, you have to have these structures that help you. Otherwise, it's just, you know, you can do anything. And doing anything is not enough to help you be motivated, really, is it?
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting you're saying, you know, there's a prompt. And it's Stephen King's giving you the prompt, yeah? So immediately that makes the box, that kind of makes the box smaller than it would be if you just said, write whatever you want. Mm. Actually, it makes it more fun. It's just like, okay, so within this space, what can I do? And it really helps to concentrate the creative energy. So
I'm excited about that. Of course I won't win, but, you know.
But just the thought that he's going to read what you write. I mean, again, that's a nice social motivation.
Exactly. So I just one more question before we finish. You're, as I said, you've been a coach for creatives for ages, years and years. And, you know, you talk to a lot of people and helping them get to a new level with their creativity. And you've certainly helped me over the years. I wondered, what is the most common issue that you see with creatives and that the listeners might also be feeling, and how can they get over that? Apart from motivation, obviously.
I would say it's ourselves. Yeah, this is the biggest thing I work on with clients. They generally come to me because it's not about how to. I mean, they'll go to other people for how to advice, or they'll Google it. You can Google how to write a novel or become a millionaire or whatever it is. But the thing that's going to make the biggest difference about whether you actually do finish the novel or become a millionaire or whatever it may be is you. And so what I work on is people's self-awareness, helping them to realize that the reality that they're creating inside here doesn't necessarily match up with the one out there. And if we can widen this and open this up, that makes it so much easier to, I mean, and this translates into creative goals, into professional goals, sometimes commercial goals as well. And we address all of that, but it's got to come from the inside out. So I would say, you know, if you're looking for one thing that's going to make the biggest difference in your career, a bit of self-knowledge.
Know thyself.
Know thyself, indeed.
There we go. So where can people find you and your books and everything you do online?
Okay, so lateralaction.com is my main website. And if you go to there /books, you'll find my books. And that's where I have a blog about creativity and matters pertaining to that for creative professionals of all kinds. I've also got my free 26-week creative career course, the Creative Pathfinder, so you can go and sign up for that. And that's the site where I talk about my coaching service. My poetry site is markmcginnis.com, and I've got a few poems on there, and I also blog about poetry. And I don't really make any concessions there. It's just like that's what I enthuse about, the kind of poetry I like and the kind of ideas I have. So it's more of a practitioner's site. But, you know, even non-poets tell me that they get quite a lot out of reading it. They say it's quite an interesting perspective on things. So
fantastic. And as ever, you're a great example of someone who combines creative and entrepreneurship. And I always love talking to you, Mark. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jo. It's lovely to be back, because it's a great thing you're doing for writers here. And, you know, I tune in every week, so I feel like I'm inside the radio this week.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
Okay.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.